Dr. Paul Ginsberg leads the Center for Studying Health System Change in Washington, D.C. His frequent, insightful, and articulate contributions to the New England Journal of Medicine and the policy journal Health Affairs result in his being named high on any list of influential persons in healthcare. Paul, thank you for joining us today. You've been a public trustee of the American Academy of Ophthalmology for quite a few years now. What is your role with the Academy and why do you do it?
Well, my role at the Academy is to bring a different perspective to the deliberations of the Board of Trustees, the perspective as best I can represent it of the public. The Academy has had a role for public trustees for a long time before I got there, but I very much enjoy working with the board, both the caliber of the people on the board, their openness to ideas, and the fact that the organization is just so well run.
Well, I know that your contributions are valued highly by everyone around the table and certainly are of great benefit to not only the Academy but the public at large. So on behalf of the Academy, thank you very much for your service in that role. Let's talk a little bit about what seems to be the predominant policy issue of our time, healthcare costs. Why does healthcare costs, why are they so much more in the United States than in other countries?
Well, I think there are two reasons that I've gleaned from the literature on this. One is that the prices are higher. And I think part of this is because most European countries have, whether they're single payer or multiple payer, there's coordinated negotiation or setting of prices. And of course, we don't have that in this country. So that's one of the factors. And actually, an interesting McKinsey study had shown how in outpatient facility services that the other countries in the OECD are much more efficient than we are. And it's believed that because they have lower prices, it's harder to make money in the other OECD countries on, you know, running a surgery center or some other, whether it's a hospital or freestanding outpatient facilities. I think the other factor is that we embrace new technology, I would say, recklessly. that we, you know, we bring it into our practice before we know much about whether it works. And actually, even for new technology that is proven to be valuable to some patients, we tend to use it beyond the patients where it has real value to a different degree than other countries do.
To expand on that just a bit, I would assume that you include under new technology not just machines and gee whiz-bang sort of things in the operating room, but blood tests, new medicines, that sort of thing as well?
Oh, yes. You know, a lot of, certainly a lot of diagnostic procedures, you know, things that can be done outside of the operating room. Although when it comes to prescription drugs, there we may be somewhat slower in bringing new things into our delivery system because of our regulatory process is actually, you know, takes longer and is somewhat more deliberative.
Mm-hmm. What are some other lessons that we can learn from other countries?
Well, you know, I think that even though some countries, you know, come out of different political cultures and, you know, we certainly, that wouldn't make any sense to say we'll be like Canada. But there are lots of aspects of their delivery system that are not so dependent on that and actually are transferable. For instance, you know, issues like you know, how to practice primary care, medical homes. There's really a lot that we could learn from other countries. And so in a sense, and I think there's a lot more study now of other advanced health systems in the United States than there used to be. So I think we're getting better set up for some of the opportunities in transferring what I call the technologies of delivery of care.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. Well, we're going to need every advance we can get as our population in the U.S. Ages. What kind of changes do you envision we need to make to meet the healthcare needs of our population?
Well, I think that in large part, the aging of our population isn't happening that quickly. I've done a lot of work on how much we should expect as far as rising spending as a result of our aging population, and the, you know, I think my conclusion from of the literature is perhaps about 0.4% a year higher than it was in the past. When and this, of course, our population has been aging for a long time, but the key thing is that it seems as though once you pass your mid-50s, then the consequences of aging for spending and healthcare needs seems to accelerate. But in a sense, you know, we've treated lots of aged people for a long time. I think it's going to be just a matter of degree. I do think that by having a larger aged population, I think we're going to start paying more attention to some of the unique needs of people who are elderly, which I think we've done a pretty poor job on. That you know, many of my peers who have aging parents, you know, characterize, you know, what happens in the fee-for-service Medicare system as, you know, scary because there's nobody to really manage the care of an elderly individual. And I am hoping that whether it's accountable care organizations or other innovations in delivery, that we can really, you know, address this issue of someone to coordinate care for, particularly for an elderly person.
Paul, you've commented that the current budget environment as regards health care reform kind of reminds you of the mid-1980s. How so?
Well, you know, we've, you know, many people having, you know, witnessed what happened during the past decade are not aware that, you know, we have had periods where there's been much greater attention to the federal budget deficit than there has been for some time. It almost seemed to me that, you know, in the 1980s, there were many steps that Congress took that addressed rising spending. Actually, this happened in the 1990s as well, and we were seemed to be so successful at that that we actually got our budget into balance. And then came 9/11, and it seemed as though after that we not only spent very freely on homeland security and national defense, but we did a lot of other things as if we had no budget constraints. And you know, most striking in healthcare is we legislated a Medicare drug benefit, something that has really been long needed, but we did it without paying for it. And so, you know, I think what's happened is that, you know, over the past year, it's become very clear how dire actually our long-term fiscal outlook is. I think a lot worse than it was in the 1980s. And whereas we're, you know, having a process now with a super committee to come up with additional cuts, I think this is just the very beginning of many processes to go and address our fiscal challenges.
You've described the relationship of quality, outcomes, and value as a frontier. Can you expand on that?
Oh, sure. You know, what I would say, you know, when economists think of something that has two dimensions, and in healthcare, let's think about quality and cost. They have a concept of a frontier, which is where you get where, in order to improve on one dimension, you have to sacrifice on the other dimension. And, you know, you could apply this to healthcare, saying, well, there's cost and quality, and there's potentially a frontier. But I, and I think many others, believe that we are, in a sense, maybe lucky in healthcare, because I don't think we're anywhere near the frontier. And I think there are many opportunities to actually improve on both dimensions. So in a sense, we can improve outcomes in healthcare, we can improve quality in healthcare without increasing costs, perhaps even decreasing costs, if we do it the right way.
Mm-hmm.
So because we're not at the frontier, we actually can accomplish a lot before we have to confront these inevitable trade-offs.
Mm-hmm. Excellent. I guess the bottom line for a lot of people is, do we, and we meaning patients and payers, providers, everyone, do we really want to pay for better quality?
You know, I think at this point, we're afraid not to pay for better quality. But I think when we talk about patients, payers, they're starting to become more demanding about, well, what does quality really mean and how do we measure it? And I think what's been striking over the last 10 years, and it will continue, is advances in the measurements of quality. Because I think we're not willing to just say, oh, we need to pay more for something because otherwise the quality will decline. We're getting much more objective and concrete about, well, let's go out and measure quality, and when we can measure it, we will pay more for better quality, and we will not allow poorer quality. So I think part of the evolution is that we're going to develop a much better sense of what quality means, but I think we're going to definitely be willing to pay for more better quality.
Mm-hmm.
And I think better quality really means when the outcomes are better.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. You know, looking back on your writings, which are so prescient in many ways, I think people think you have a crystal ball somewhere. But if you do or if you don't, regardless, what will the payment structure in your mind look like in this country in a decade?
Well, I think it's pretty clear that there's going to be a probably lengthy transition away from fee-for-service towards more bundled payments. So, you know, I think there certainly are pilots going on to, say, for surgery, to which, of course, has always been the physician has been paid a global fee, but to combine payments to the facility and the physician and post-acute care, if it's necessary, into a single amount. Sure, many of the listeners are familiar with accountable care organizations, which I would refer to as, capitation light.
Mm-hmm.
Finding a way with a much looser payment method than capitation, where much looser allegiance of patients to a particular delivery system, but still work some of the population-based incentives. Now, fee-for-service will always be there. There'll always be some services that fee-for-service is just a better way to pay for than whether to use a global payment or something that includes elements of capitation. But the trend is going to be to reduce the proportion of services where fee-for-service is the only method used.
Mm-hmm. This past summer you published an article in the New England Journal of Medicine on ACOs, prognosticating a bit about what might happen now that that's in the law. Can you maybe summarize for our listeners what your thoughts are about the prognosis, if you will, for ACOs in the next maybe 5 years, let's say?
Yes, well, what I'm sensing is really broad interest in the delivery system to be able to move in the direction of something like an ACO. I often use the term ACO-like payment systems, meaning that, you know, whatever specifically comes out of Medicare may not be what is most useful. But basically, an ACO provides, fairly limited, but not zero, incentives for a delivery system to take into account, patient-based payment. Mm-hmm. So, an ACO can take many forms. It can be a multi-specialty physician group, or it can be, you know, some type of partnership between a hospital and either individual physicians or physician organizations. I think it can take many forms. There was a lot of disappointment with the proposed rule that came out of the Medicare program about the shared savings ACO program. And I think that people have turned their attention somewhat away from Medicare towards various ACO-like contracts between providers and private insurers. So there's a lot of activity there. I think for a few years it's just going to be, you know, particularly well-positioned organizations, contracting like this, but with some success, it will expand further to less sophisticated organizations.
Mm-hmm. The transition that you think will occur over the next several years from fee-for-service to more bundled payments, in the meantime, is the current approach with the tools that we're, you know, kind of using, MedPAC, the RUC, Super Committee, et cetera, is this tenable? Is it going to work? Is it going to get us where we need to go, or at least catalyze the transition that we need to see happen?
Yes. Well, you know, when you mentioned the the RUC and MedPAC, I gather you're talking about maintaining the Medicare physician fee schedule. And I would say that the Medicare physician fee schedule is going to be just about as important for physician payment 10 years down the road as it is today.
Mm-hmm.
Because even though fee-for-service payment may be de-emphasized, the physician fee schedule will be the building block that is behind these other payment systems. So, you know, think about accountable care organizations or ACOs. Basically, they're going to still be paying on a fee-for-service basis under ACOs, but then there'll be some calculation of savings and a sharing of savings. So, in a sense, the relevance of the RUC and MedPAC will be just as strong, even if we have what we call payment reform. Now, there's a very substantial agenda in the Affordable Care Act for CMS in refining and improving the Medicare fee schedule and doing a better job at keeping it up to date. I've written many times that I thought that the process of keeping the fee schedule up to date has not gone well, and it's been a process that's in a sense neglected taking into account learning curves, in a sense, new technology that's not so new anymore. Physicians get better at doing it. Better equipment and supplies are provided to do it. And our process has really not been up to speed as far as identifying relative values that need to be reduced. And there's a pretty strong mandate from Congress and the Affordable Care Act for CMS to do this. So I think there's going to be probably more and more visible activity in maintaining and refining the fee schedule over the next few years, even as the payment system moves beyond fee-for-service.
Mm-hmm. Well, Paul, again, I want to thank you on behalf of the Academy and the patients we serve for the terrific input that you provide to the board of directors and to other leaders in medicine. Your approach is thoughtful and methodical and most appreciated. And we certainly appreciate you taking time today in your busy schedule to visit with us. And we'll look forward to seeing you at the next meeting.
Oh, thank you very much. It's been a pleasure to have this conversation with you, and look forward to seeing you at the next board meeting.
Take care now. See
you.
Bye-bye.